trying something new is always scary. We never know what the outcome might be. People could love it or people could hate it. When it comes to art, you need to be willing to experiment. You have to go out of your comfort zone and try things that make you uncomfortable. If you look around at artists, writers, filmmakers, they all seem to do their best work when they step outside their comfort zone and try something more ambitious. Today's guest started out painting very traditional portraits and figurative work. But it wasn't until he stepped outside his comfort zone that things truly took off. I'm your host, Jacob Johnson. This is the My Art Is Real podcast, a narrative journey into the lives that shape art. Today's episode, Paul Reed. Right after the break. I have some big news. I now have over 40 bonus clips on the Patreon page. These are clips from previous episodes that didn't quite make the final cut, but are still incredibly interesting. I've got artists talking about world building, overcoming creative blocks, trying to be a good father, and so much more inspiring content. If you enjoy this show and want to help me continue telling these stories, head over to patreon.com/myartisreal and get immediate access to all the content, plus everything that I'm working on coming in the future. Another great way to support the show is by collecting one of the My Art Is Real art prints. These are collaborations with previous guests and other talented art friends. You'll be supporting both the show and the artists at the same time. Check them out at myartisreal.com. Back to the episode.
Well, my name is Paul Rees. I'm a full-time artist and have been since 1999. I graduated, so long time now. I'm originally from a small city called Perth in Scotland, in the UK, and now I live just outside of Edinburgh.
And how was it for you growing up in that town?
It was a mix of when I grew up. I mean, it was what you would call a council estate, so it was, you know, quite a large estate with lots of houses that looked very similar. My family didn't have a massive amount of money or anything. My dad was a sheet metal worker, which is, you know, welding and constructing things using sheet metal. And my mum did various different jobs throughout the years, but mostly kind of brought up the kids. But I spent a lot of time outdoors as a kid, but at the same time had a good deal of, at the time it was kind of computer games were kind of beginning to become a big thing, and movies were a big thing. So it was the 1980s when I was kind of younger. So I had a good mix of playing outside and at the same time the kind of beginnings of what we all spend a lot of time doing, which is watching movies and playing computer games.
And what sort of things were you and your friends getting into running around doing?
Oh, just games with my friends. We skateboards, bikes. Although we lived on a housing estate, there was, a river not too far away, plus forests and things. So making dens, playing in the park, all sorts. I mean, you know, play games where we would just wander for miles and miles, chasing each other or playing on bridges. There was always a bit of, you know, climbing involved in trees and things like that. Yeah, fairly typical kind of young kids playing.
My parents were always very strict about where I was going and what I was doing. As an adult, I see why they were so worried about me. But as a kid, you just want to run around and play and not be bothered. Paul had an immense amount of freedom, but he was always home when he needed to be.
My mom and dad always made sure I came home by a certain time at night. You know, I mean, I wasn't allowed to I always seemed to be the one who was leaving first. When we were out playing, you know, apologizing to my friends and having to head home earlier than they were. But we still, yeah, we had a wide range that we played in. You know, it wasn't like we just stayed, you know, within a few doors or within a few blocks. It was quite free, yeah, in a way that, and I do understand it because I have my own kids now. And we, you know, they don't go out and wander like I did when I was young. And it's definitely now it does seem people are far more scared of their kids just wandering off.
At a young age, Paul also became immersed in video games and movies. What sort of games did you start getting into and playing a lot as a kid at that time?
Well, when we were growing up in the UK, you know, you guys would have had the Commodore and Amstrad, home computers. And we had those two. But the one that we all played on was called the ZX Spectrum, which was not available anywhere but in the UK, I think. And it was basically a home computer, quite, you know, very slight in terms of power compared to what they could do these days. And the games looked more like early Game Boy things. You know, they were kind of monochrome. I remember the beginnings of almost like 3D games and things happening on the Spectrum and the Commodore and those kind of early home computers, you know. I remember the very first games that I played, basically just letters on the screen going around, like so Pac-Man with ghosts, but instead of graphics, it was just numbers and letters, you know, it was so basic. It was like that. But then within a few years' time, they got better, they got more powerful, and developers got good at making games for it. By the end of the kind of lifespan of this computer, the games were, you know, really quite complicated. I mean, the first kind of sandbox games I remember where you could kind of wander around in an area and just do things. And me and my friends were kind of obsessed by these games.
Besides video games, Paul was always drawing. Like most kids, just sketching whatever came to his mind on the borders of his paper in class.
My parents have got, you know, school books of mine with lots of drawings in it. I remember when I used to just be at school, I would do an essay or something that you had to write, and I would try and finish it as quick as I could so I could do the drawings at the bottom. And in the early days, you know, when I was 5 or 6, 7 years old, it was just dinosaurs. I just drew dinosaurs all the time, you know, like a lot of kind of school kids was obsessed by dinosaurs. I just drew it all the time. I mean, I remember I used to look forward to the kind of winter evenings when nobody was really outside because it was too dark, because then I could sit inside and draw pictures and I used to invent my own comic books and things, you know, stories and pictures. I would spend hours just kind of bent over a piece of paper or a sketch pad. And yeah, in the early days, it was kind of comics and movies and things that I was drawing mostly.
Paul fell in love with movies, which not only influenced his very early drawings, but also continue to influence the massive oil paintings he creates today. Looking back during that time, what were the movies that you were really into?
I grew up in what they called the video nasty period. We had a video store across the road from us. And it was when, you know, movies like, I remember when I was quite young watching things like The Evil Dead, zombie movies, werewolf movies like The Howling and things like that, which, you know, I wasn't old enough to be watching, but I loved those things anyway. And then when I was a little bit older, it was movies like Alien, Aliens, Predator, all those kind of things, which I absolutely loved. Anything with a monster was, you know, a favourite. And then I also used to love, people always ask me, oh, where do you get the Greek myth thing from? And sometimes I think it's from, I don't know if you'll know them, but the Ray Harryhausen movies. He was a special effects wizard in the kind of 1960s, the kind of stop motion animation. He did Clash of the Titans and Jason and the Argonauts and a lot of the Sinbad movies where, you know, the movie was just built around a special effect of a monster of some kind, you know. So his famous ones are the Medusa in Clash of the Titans and the Kraken at the end of that movie. And yeah, I used to watch these movies and just wait for the monster to turn up because that was the best bit. And used to love those kind of animations, you know, the little models, the stop motion things. And then obviously during the 1980s, special effects were becoming better and better. So any movie that had special effects and monsters was a favorite of mine.
I mean, we all love a good monster movie, but did your parents care? Like if you were watching these kind of films as a kid?
No, they were quite accepting. I had an aunt and uncle who loved horror films as well. And so I used to sit and watch them. My grandmother as well used to sit and watch horror movies with me. I don't know why. Everybody seemed to like them, yeah. But the difference is I remember watching The Evil Dead. And when I was a kid, now when I watch it, strikes me as like a horror comedy. You know, it's so over the top and silly. You just almost laugh at it. The special effects are bad, you know, it's all kind of low budget. But back then I was terrified. But I remember clearly my aunt and uncle just laughing the whole time when they watched it. You know, but this was an 18, you know, and again, the UK censors cut bits out of it. You know, they took bits of some of the worst bits were cut from the VHS, you know, video. Yeah, but no, my parents watched horror movies and things, so they didn't really tend to worry too much about it. damaging us. Anyway.
I've been thinking about this question we all get asked at some point in our lives. The question is, what do you want to be when you grow up? From adolescence all the way into adulthood, we're made to believe we need to be just one thing, and whatever we choose, it ought to be profitable. I used to call myself a curator, but as I've gotten older and started expressing ideas through other mediums, I'm hesitant to use that word, not to mention that most people have no idea what a curator actually is. But honestly, I don't think that one word even begins to describe who I even am. I consider myself an artist, a writer, I'm a podcast host, I'm a husband. The list goes on and on. I put on various hats throughout the day, but are any of these profitable endeavors? Sure, some people make it as a full-time artist, but even more do not. Does that mean you shouldn't at least try to be one of the few who makes it? I personally say chase that dream. Go for it. And Paul, well, Paul wanted nothing more than to go for that dream.
Always, you know, whenever I went to the careers advisor at school or whatever, you know, and they would say, what do you want to be when you grow up, if you like? I would always just say, well, an artist, you know, and they would be like, all right, okay, well, not very many people get to do that. So have you got anything else you want to do? No, an artist. So that was just always the answer, you know. But I think when I was up until about age 18 or 19, when I went to art school, I wanted to do comic art of some kind, you know, because that's what I was interested in. But then I flipped that when I went to art college into wanting to do sort of, well, they called it fine art then. I don't know if that's really a term people use anymore. But yeah, I always wanted to do it. So it feels, sometimes it does feel a bit strange that I'm basically still doing my hobby as an adult, and should I really have gotten a real job? Sometimes I get a slight uneasy feeling when I think of people around me with what I would regard as, you know, grown-up jobs. people that learn how to properly do something and then, you know, work for a big company or, you know, they, and then I just think, all right, I just sit in my studio all day and basically do what I did when I was 6 years old, which is invent pictures, you know, and paint them. I realise I was very lucky to be able to do that, but sometimes it does feel like you kind of haven't properly grown up, maybe.
Today, we'll learn how Paul managed to turn his childhood hobby into a full-on career. And while he's not working for some big company, he sure as hell has made an impact on people around the world and brought joy to many who have seen his works. I'd say that's just as important, but maybe I'm being biased. I do, in fact, do a podcast about art. When Paul first got into art school, he tried to focus on illustration. He was always a fan of comic books, and being an illustrator seemed like a path that could pay the bills.
Initially, I was going to go and study illustration, I think, you know, because that was that seemed like a more structured kind of career. So even if it wasn't comic books, maybe it would be illustration and comic books or, you know, things like that. And then I think I knew I had 4 or 5 years to figure it out when I was there, so I didn't overly worry about it. And then, yeah, I got into fine art quite quickly when I went into art college. And then I'm not even sure what I thought about the careers, because art college, it didn't really focus on that at all. When I was at art college, it was almost like making money from your art was bad. It was a bad thing. That meant you'd kind of sold out, you know. Really, you should be in an attic room somewhere pouring your soul out over artworks that nobody can understand. That seemed to be the general idea behind art college. At a weird, very weird kind of place. And then, yeah, we didn't really get taught very much in terms of technique, things like that. So I really had to kind of teach myself how to oil paint, which was bizarre. Go to art college and not really get taught any art. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't very structured. It was basically this idea that you went there and you found yourself and then you expressed yourself. And if that was slapping paint all over big canvases in a kind of wild manner, then great. If it was video art, then great. If it was installation, then great. But if you wanted to do kind of almost classically inspired or comic book inspired figurative art, then they weren't so keen on that.
Why do you think that they didn't support the more figurative style of art you wanted to create? Do you think it was just that particular school?
Well, no, it was quite prevalent at the time. It was during the mid to late 1990s when I was there. It was at the height of what was a movement in
art called the YBAs, which was the Young British Artists. So it was Damien Hirst, Rachel Whitread, Tracy Emin were big name artists at the time. And there was a prize in the UK called the Turner Prize, which was famous for all sorts of wacky kind of artworks winning lots of money. You know, it was very influential at the time. So to be just wanting to paint the human figure was backwards. That was, you know, that was traditional art. That was not very avant-garde. It was not very... So yeah, there was no real training involved. You weren't expected just to do your own thing. Find yourself, if you like.
What was it exactly that drew you into the fine art, more to the more figurative side of painting?
Yeah, well, because I was into comic art, illustration, I was always enjoyed, you know, drawing and painting and drawing the human figure. You know, I was drawing Batman and Judge Dredd and things like that as a teenager and learning anatomy and how it works and how to draw the human figure. And then when it came to doing fine art, you know, that's kind of why I gravitated towards sort of classical or old master paintings, because they were the same thing. It was the same sort of technique. It was, you know, being able to draw a human figure correctly or nearly correctly. And worrying about things like lighting and colour and composition and all those things that, you know, used to be important and prevalent in fine art but had become much less so, but it was still something that you had to do if you wanted to be an illustrator or a comic book artist or even like, you know, a movie conceptual artist, something like that. These are all things that they still had to learn, but in fine art they didn't teach anymore.
These days we have YouTube and the internet full of resources for learning new things, but Paul didn't have any of that back then. How were you going about teaching yourself these techniques that they weren't teaching you in class?
Mostly through two or three kind of old textbooks. There was one in particular that was from the early 20th century by a German author who nobody's really heard of anymore. But it was a long book about kind of traditional techniques, you know, oil painting, how to make your own oil paints, how to make your own kind of canvas grounds, how to, you know, stretch and make canvas and properly paint an oil painting from the bottom up. So I think when I was in second year at art college, I took some of the time that I had just to learn as much as that of that as I could. Whilst at the same time, we were lucky that we still had life models that you could go to the kind of, you know, the life room and study, you know, life models and draw and paint. So I did a lot of that as well. So it was basically kind of trying to, you know, learn as much as I could my own studies. But yeah, you're right. Nowadays it would just be YouTube. Which is what I did when I learned Photoshop, you know. I just went onto YouTube and taught myself Photoshop.
Being able to actually sit down and teach yourself something, focus and be motivated, what was your motivation to go the extra mile and learn these things on your own?
It was that thing of, you know, going into like the National Gallery here in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and seeing a painting on the wall and then going up as close as you possibly could get to try and figure out the technique, you know, that kind of almost magical, you know, oil painting technique that a lot of artists, the great artists had, and just really, really wanting to kind of unlock some of those secrets and, you know, how is it done? And, you know, how can I replicate that? Can I do that in my own work? You know? So yeah, it was I spent a lot of time just trying and failing, you know, I ordered all the pigments from art stores and then made my own oil paints and all that kind of thing just to learn as much as I could. Because I felt at the time that the shop-bought oil paints were just not quite good enough, you know. So I was very motivated to do it. And although I say to you that, you know, the art college wasn't exactly supportive of that thing, there was the odd tutor here and there who did like the same kind of things I did, who would come down and say, oh, I can see you know, making your own oil paints and things like that. That was really fascinating. So there was there was always somebody somewhere that would share your enthusiasm.
Through school and after graduating from university, Paul was able to land some residencies all over Europe. He didn't have to worry just yet about starting his career and continued honing in on his style and technique. How did it feel during that time of your life when you're traveling to all these old cities like Florence and Madrid and getting to absorb all this rich art history?
Yeah, well, pretty amazing. It was almost like, I'd finished college and I didn't really have a career as yet. So again, it was almost like good time to disappear off and not worry too much about, you know, making a living yet, because the scholarships, they gave you money to go and do that, of course. I had a bit of extra money because actually, unlike a lot of artists at their degree shows, you know, that's where you show your work for people to judge and then it's open to the public. I did sell most of the work that was in my show. But Madrid, mostly I spent my time in the Prado studying Velázquez and Goya, Titian, has a lot of, and Rubens, you know, just kind of every day sort of going in and staring and doing drawings from these paintings and things, you know. And that was great. It was super, super hot. That was the only problem. It was, you know, we're not used to that kind of heat here in Scotland. So it was, I was there in, July. Anyway, and then Florence actually was after Madrid. It was kind of 10 weeks closer to sort of September, October, November time. And yeah, that's just an amazing city just to be able to wander about, you know. And I remember in particular, you know, sitting in the kind of main square, the Piazza Vecchio, I think it's called, where they have the kind of Michelangelo's David, not the real one now, it's a fake because they moved the real one indoors. And then they have this kind of sculpture area with Gian Bologna and other famous sculptures there. And I remember sitting there at 3 a.m. with nobody around, just looking at these amazing kind of works of art. And I was there at 3 a.m. because we'd all been out drinking and things, you know. I was only in my early 20s, so we're doing a lot of that as well.
Finding your style in your voice in whatever medium you choose can be tough. We start out trying to copy our idols and pulling little bits and pieces from here and there, combining them into something that we think would be cool. After art college, Paul had began to send his work out to various magazines and ended up getting featured in one. This feature got his foot in the door with some galleries, and before long he was showcasing his works and making a living as an artist. But his style back then, it started out quite differently from what it is today. And when the Minotaur stuff came about, how did the audience react to it?
The Minotaur thing, it was something I always wanted to do, I think, but plucking up the courage to kind of go for it. And also the thing is that I was showing in galleries that were maybe a bit conservative in terms of the sort of things that they wanted to show. So to have a Minotaur just appear on the wall was a little bit risky, you know, a little bit. A lot of the people that were buying my paintings in the early years of my career were kind of, you know, an older generation, people with money, and they preferred things that were not going to scare anybody when they came into their house. Because I remember somebody saying to me, I had the very first Minotaur I ever painted, and they did sell it through a gallery down in England. And there was a kind of newspaper journalist wanted to sort of interview me about the painting. You know, and the first thing he said to me was, oh, I love it, I love it. You know, and I can imagine it in a museum, but I would never put it on my wall. And yeah, that was always, you know, a slight worry, is that you do these kind of slightly freaky kind of creatures and monsters and things that some people would just not be into that at all. And the Minotaur Man thing is basically because, you know, a few years after I'd done that Minotaur painting, you know, it became quite well known in various art circles, I think. And I was speaking to a gallery owner and I said to him, well, do you know my work? And he said, yeah, you're the Minotaur Man, aren't you?
And just like that, Paul became the Minotaur Man. But he didn't just wake up one day and decide to paint Minotaurs. This Greek mythology had started to play a big role in his work long before that, going all the way back to his days in art college.
Yeah, well, I remember, you know, those movies I was telling you about, Clash of the Titans, things like that. I loved those as a kid, and I had various books about Greek mythology and was always aware of it, you know, and always fascinated by the monsters, in particular the Minotaur and the Gorgon, you know, Medusa. And I remember I had, when I was growing up, you had these, they were called Ladybird books, and they were like sort of educational books. And I had those two myths, and they were illustrated, and I can still remember some of the illustrations. You know, I loved those books. And then when I sort of went to art college, I was doing a lot of oil painting, teach myself oil painting. I was doing portraits mostly and still lives and things where I could just concentrate on the technique in the painting, you know. And there were a couple of tutors who did say to me, you know, we can see that you're good at this and that you're good at portraiture, but is that what you want to be? Do you really want to just paint pots and pans and things? Not that there's anything wrong with that. I know people spend their whole career doing that, do wonderful things with that. But I think they were wondering whether maybe there was something else I might want to do. And then I kind of thought, you know, going back to my sort of comic book thing, you know, I'm telling stories might be a good thing to be able to do with my art. And then it was a case of, well, what stories could I do? You know, and I was getting into the old masters at the time. These names kept popping up, Ovid, Homer, you know, like Rubens used Ovid's Metamorphoses for a lot of his work. You know, I thought to myself, you know, I could look at that kind of thing.
So he tried his hand at mixing some of these Greek myths into his style.
There was a famous poet, Ted Hughes, in the UK. He's dead now. But there was a book that at the time I was at art college was just published, and it was like 24 passages from Ovid's Metamorphoses, and he translated them into English in his own sort of poetic in a way, you know, so they were very loose translations that he did. And so I bought that and kind of read through that, and I was amazed by how visceral they were, how kind of gory. And, you know, one of the first ones that I read and the one that I made into my sort of degree show painting was the death of Actaeon. Actaeon was a hunter, and he was out with his dogs, and he stumbled across the goddess Diana in Roman mythology, or Artemis in Greek, who was a kind of the goddess of the moon and a chaste goddess. So she was a kind of virgin goddess, and she was not to be seen by a mortal man in the nude. And he stumbles across her bathing in the woods. And as punishment, she kind of flicks this water onto him, and he transforms into a stag, and then is hunted and ripped to shreds by his own dogs. You know, so pretty rough. It's a rough day. But it was all described in graphic detail, almost like a horror movie or something scene, you know. And I just loved it. I just thought, wow, this is amazing. And it put so many images into my head of all these stories.
So now he knew what he wanted to paint. But how was he going to fit these epic stories onto the canvas?
And then so it was kind of a struggle to figure out how to make these stories into large paintings, you know, because it's one thing to learn the technique and to learn how to oil paint, but then you've also got to compose a large canvas with multiple figures. And if it's mythology, then it probably have landscape elements and then magical elements of, you know, other animals, you know. It was quite a kind of tall order to figure out how to do all that. But it was an enjoyable challenge, I think. And then throughout the whole of third year at college, I remember I did two or three kind of big mythological canvases and then destroyed them all at the end of the year because they just weren't up to scratch. And then it wasn't until fourth year that it all started to come together. And I did a really large painting of the death of Actaeon with five or six characters in it. And that was successful enough to then kind of go from there.
As Paul paints these works, he's not only tapping into his love of storytelling, but also his love of classic movie monsters, interpreting them in a way that feels more grounded and relatable for the audience.
Mythology, I mean, it's a huge subject. And, you know, so if I do something like a Minotaur, which was something that as a child I remember reading about the Minotaur, and it just appealed to me straight away because of, the monstrous side of it. You know, so when I'm painting Minotaurs and things, on one hand I'm doing this cool thing that I used to do as a kid, which is just sit and create stories and paint monsters. And then on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, this is a creature with serious kind of, you know, baggage, you know, historical baggage that, you know, throughout history has become a famous monster, a famous story. You know, Picasso was obsessed by the Minotaur. Other artists have used it. And then there's obviously things like the fact that the bull's head on the man's body can be, you know, there's all sorts of interpretations for that, all different, you know, views as to what that can mean. What I tend to do is not worry too much about those things when I'm painting the thing, because it can cramp you, you know, it can make you question everything that you're doing. So rather than just going, I've learned over the years, when I was at art college, you were always told to make sure you knew exactly what the theory was behind the art that you were doing. You know, my art college course was very theory-based. You had to write down what the art was about, and what you were doing and why you were doing it. What did it mean? And, you know, how could it change this or do that, or, you know, and I really didn't enjoy that side of it. And I've learned over the years to kind of rely more on just what feels right to me and then to go with it. Decide to paint a Minotaur, go for it, you know, let's do it. It feels right, so just go for it. And then afterwards, kind of worry about what it might mean to people or how it might change people's perceptions or whatever else.
At this point, Paul has been showcasing and selling his works for over 20 years. He's developed a style that is not only personal to him, but also resonates with many of the viewers. But that doesn't mean the past two decades have been easy. He's experienced plenty of highs and lows along the way. Have there been times in your career where you were worried you might have to put down the paintbrush and get a normal job?
A few times, yeah. There were a few difficult times. I remember having one large exhibition in Edinburgh, and it was a massive success. And I thought, well, that's it. You know, I've made it. You know, brilliant. And then just 2 years later, in the same gallery with the same amount of work, selling almost nothing, and thinking, wow, okay, that was that was different. And then coming away from that exhibition with not very much money at all. And then sort of struggling for a few months, got through that. But then from there, bizarrely, and this was the beginnings of my kind of social media sort of getting work from social media, if you like. I should really say that before that, a few years before that, I did a commission through the gallery that I showed with for J.K. Rowling, you know, the Harry Potter author. And then I had this difficult period where I didn't have any much work. And then she got in contact with me through Twitter asking for another commission. And so kind of went from, you know, having very little money all of a sudden to having a big commission again and kind of riding high. So when I say highs and lows, I mean, there were quite extreme highs and lows sometimes. But that was kind of the beginning of really moving more away from the traditional gallery model into kind of social media and things, you know, which I'm still, most of the work for the past 3 or 4 years has come through Twitter.
Like everything else, the art world is constantly changing and evolving, and Paul has done his best to embrace these changes. The first big shift, putting his work online, something he had spent a lot of time avoiding.
It used to be people would always say to me, oh, you know, the internet's going to be a big thing, you know, before it was. You should get your work on the internet. You should have your own website, things like that, you know. And I kind of resisted for a while, just thinking, well, I pay the gallery commission for the gallery to do all that. You know, they do the internet stuff, and they have their website, you know, so they should be doing all that. I don't need to bother. So I was just kind of sitting in my studio painting away and then giving the paintings to the galleries, not worrying too much about it. And then I kind of got my first smartphone, you know, because I had various, like a lot of people, various phones that were moving towards a smartphone, you know. And then my very first one I remember was a Windows phone, you know, the Microsoft. I just thought, yeah, everybody keeps going on about social media being the new thing where you can go and show your work. And maybe, so I kind of got a smartphone, went on to, you know, went onto Facebook, Twitter, and set up accounts and thought, well, you know, if I show the work, can people see it? Great. If not, I'm not worried about it, you know, and just kind of started doing that. I didn't do Instagram because Windows Phone didn't support Instagram back then, weirdly. Twitter was the one where I met a lot of other artists, guys from comic books, guys from, you know, computer game designers, computer game artists, all those kind of things. And to begin with, for the first few years, it was just enjoyable just meeting other artists and showing work and things like that.
Eventually, he started to make sales through social media and even landing new commission jobs. But during another low point, he became increasingly worried about his income, so he decided to focus on learning a new skill.
Weirdly, you know, when you spoke about highs and lows, I had a particular low point where I was kind of struggling with selling some art in the real world, if you like. And so I decided that maybe I should get myself a new skill, which would be Photoshop, which might, if I needed to, open up other doors to other things that I could maybe do. So I decided to, you know, get myself a laptop and a drawing tablet and teach myself Photoshop. This was must have been maybe 8 or 9 years ago now. But then, like all these things, soon after I did that, I then sold working galleries again and things, and then I didn't really need to bother that much about it. But I started down that path, so I decided I would keep going with it. And so I taught myself Photoshop. Did two or three kind of pieces on Photoshop. So the first thing I did was I took two of my oil paintings and took a figure from one and a landscape from the other and then put the two together and made a new work of art and then kind of experimented with the Photoshop brushes over the top of the oil paint to see if you could get similar effects. And it actually worked really well. I was really surprised by how well it worked. So I did this piece and it was an Actia and it's, you know, similar to the thing that I did way back in my degree show. But you had the stag's head and the man's body, and you can see it on my Instagram or Twitter. But anyway, so this was a like oil paint plus digital. This was like a mixed thing. And then I finished it and I thought, that was great. Yeah, this has worked really well. And then I thought, well, what can I do with it? Nothing. So it just sat on my hard drive. Sat on my hard drive for 2 or 3 years doing nothing.
Then these digital NFT artworks came along. If you have been listening to the podcast, you probably know what an NFT is. But basically, it's a way for digital artists to sell originals of their work using blockchain technology and cryptocurrency. So you decided to try and put out one of these digital works as an NFT. How did that go?
Yeah, I had this piece sitting on my laptop for 2 or 3 years, and I thought, well, maybe I could see if I could sell that through NFTs. And then I kind of spoke to a few people about it who told me all I needed to do, and then I managed to get onto this site called Foundation and then minted the work. And it was bought by quite a big name artist, Trevor Jones, who I kind of followed, and he followed me on Twitter, but I didn't realise he was actually Edinburgh-based. And he, like me, was an oil painter who'd gone into NFTs. And so he bought my first piece and then messaged me how much he loved the work. He'd seen my exhibitions in Edinburgh years ago. Loved my work, you know, and wanted to kind of, he wanted to get more fine art into NFTs rather than, you know, the kind of crypto punks and monkey pictures and things that people were buying. And yeah, so it just kind of went from there, really, and I sort of got more and more involved in the whole community around NFTs.
While he still creates oil paintings, the digital world has given him another outlet, one with a lot less frustration.
You know, I'd spent years and years and years oil painting, and oil painting is, it's great. And at the same time, it's really, really frustrating. I mean, it's really difficult. even after, you can be doing it for decades, and it's still just really difficult, awkward thing to use at the best of times. You know, it makes everything twice as hard. But it's messy and it's smelly and all those kind of things. So whilst I love it, at the same time, I kind of hate it. Whereas painting in Photoshop is more fun, really. You know, there's less of the... less frustration. There's, you can see so much of the image in one, if you like, in a way that you can't with oil paintings, where you've got to worry about the lighting and standing back far enough from it to get a good view of the whole thing. And you know, if there's a really dark day outside, which often is in Scotland, it's difficult to see the oil paintings sometimes, all these problems. And then you go into your laptop with Photoshop and it's all just, it all works, you know, it's all user-friendly.
So, Paul, you've been an artist for 20 years now. How does it feel to wake up every day and be making a living doing what you love?
That's a funny one, because obviously I'm aware that it's unusual to be able to do it, and it's a privilege to be able to do it. But at the same time, like anything, you know, people always say, oh, it must be wonderful just to get up in the morning and go into the studio and create. And life's not really like that. Life's more like, all right, I've got my youngest off to school in time, and then I come at the studio and you're tired already and it's not even 10 o'clock in the morning. You think, no, I've got a whole day's painting to do. Oh, and this bit here is really bothering me, and this is going to be really painful. And then it's a case of just getting on with it, you know. And I don't know if people have this idea that you're just larking around the studio, being inspired all the time, having wonderful visions of what art you're going to produce. But really, actually, I see it more as, you have this 10 minutes of inspiration of something that you want to do, and then 6 months of pain to try and get it done. You know, and everything else that gets in the way, you know, just life in general. And yeah, and art, like everything, it's just a kind of struggle to get stuff done, to get work done, and then to sell the work as well. And now, of course, you've got to manage social media accounts. And yeah, it's just... And I suppose the other thing is, I don't know any other existence, if you like, because I haven't really had a proper job. So I always take it for granted, I guess. I guess maybe if someday it all goes really badly wrong and I end up having to get a real job, then I'll know what a privilege it was.
Paul's biggest advantage in sustaining an art career for over 20 years is his willingness to try something new. From his early years in art college, when he experimented with making his own oil paints, and then when he started to translate epic myths onto canvas, and later blending his love of horror movie monsters into his work. Even more recently, he embraced the digital age with making his works digitally and selling them as NFTs. If an artist like Paul, who deeply values the techniques of the old masters and the materials he uses, can embrace new technology and find ways to let it enhance his creative process, then I'm sure you can also step outside your comfort zone and embrace the unknown. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. I know it is late being released. I've got a bunch of other interviews recorded right now, and I'm trying to line up some other guests, so hopefully get a little ahead of schedule so episodes stop being late. But I appreciate all of you who stick around and listen to each of these and stay to the end. It means the world to me that there's people that enjoy listening to these stories. I get emails a lot now where, you know, people are saying, oh, this episode connected with me, or, you know, how they felt about this one. And people tell me they've listened to every episode. And those sort of messages give me the motivation to keep going and just make me so happy knowing that there's people out there that enjoy what I'm doing and want to see more of it. So I'm going to continue to do that. If you want to help support me in doing that, you can head on over to MyArtistReel.com and get some limited edition art prints that I've made with a bunch of art friends. They're super cool. You're supporting me, you're supporting the artist, and you're getting an amazing print in the process. You can also head on over to patreon.com/MyArtistReel, where now I've uploaded over 40 different bonus clips from various previous guests talking about all sorts of other details that didn't quite make it into the final episodes. So if you want more of the MyArtistReel podcast, head on over there. It's only $3 a month, and there's even some stuff coming for free for people on there. So thank you so much for listening. And I'll see you in the next one.